Welcome back to Speaking of Mysteries. This week, in Episode 9, we have an interview with New York Times best-selling author Annie Jacobson, recorded in mid-April at the Los Angeles Times Festival of Books. In the spirit of full disclosure, Annie and I have known each other for almost a decade as colleagues and now friends. We first met right after she began her Terror in the Skies series about a terrifying incident she witnessed on a flight from Detroit to Los Angeles. The events of September 11th were still very fresh memories when Annie, sitting on a plane with her family, witnessed a group of men acting suspiciously, slipping in and out of the restroom with paper bags. They refused to obey the instructions of cabin attendants, including refusing to be seated and buckled in on landing. Annie was terrified. She asked the attendants if there was an air marshal on board and suggested in the strongest possible terms that the authorities be alerted and waiting when the plane landed. When she deplaned, the men were gone and no law enforcement was to be seen. Some people would have followed up. Most would have become frustrated. None of these people are Annie Jacobson, a journalist whose previous work had been primarily in the areas of business and finance. Annie was determined to get to the bottom of what was going on. She investigated relentlessly. She gained the trust of cabin attendants, who, after all, were on the front lines of whatever shenanigans were taking place on airplanes, and of air marshals who were disillusioned by mindless bureaucracy and misguided instructions. She found out stuff until she got a visit from the government, the discussions of which she has never revealed. In the wake of the Edward Snowden scandal and how his professional accomplishments have been minimized, he's been referred to by the president as a 29-year-old hacker and by other government officials as a low-level analyst. It's interesting how Annie, when her investigations became uncomfortable to government and law enforcement, was described as a highly excitable housewife. No. Annie Jacobson is a graduate of Princeton University and was and is a brilliant investigative journalist who has the most uncanny knack of getting people to tell her never-before-told stories. And lest you think she takes those stories at face value, it's after Annie hears the story that her work as a researcher begins, and she is a relentless miner of information. The story she hears from you or me or anyone is just the beginning. The articles and books she writes after painstaking sleuthing are the result. As an editor, Annie Jacobson is a dream come true as a provider of articles. When she calls and says, "I have something interesting," I didn't even need to hear what it was. She did that more than once when I was editor-in-chief of the Los Angeles Times Magazine. The first time she did it, she called and told me she had an interesting story about a Cold War-era secret spy plane that had been built in Burbank, California, before it was taken to Area 51. Was I interested? Oh, yeah. That two-article series drew attention. Annie began to get more information. Eventually, she had enough to write Area 51. For those of you interested in those two articles, as well as others that Annie wrote for the Los Angeles Times Magazine, please visit the Speaking of Mysteries website at speakingofmysteries.com, where there will be links to the pieces. But what we talked about in this interview was her latest book, Operation Paperclip, the secret intelligence program to bring Nazi scientists to America, is one of those stories that is so unbelievable it has to be true. After winning the war against Nazi aggression, just about the first thing the then-named War Department did was locate the top scientists of the Third Reich, not to punish them, put them on trial, expose them, but to get them to America. The U.S. government officials and those acting on behalf of the U.S. government felt they had justification. If we didn't get them, the Soviets would, they reasoned. But Operation Paperclip was the mechanism to sell this program to the American people who had just lost fathers, sons, brothers, sisters, and mothers fighting the regime for which these men had worked to secure victory. You can't make this stuff up. Operation Paperclip is not crime fiction, but it's what I call true thriller. But the best person to describe this is Annie Jacobson herself.
Hi, welcome.
Welcome back to Speaking of Mysteries. I'm here with Annie Jacobson, author of the best-selling Paperclip. I'm going to read from the thing. Paperclip, the secret intelligence program that brought Nazi scientists to America. Her previous bestseller was Area 51. And if you're wondering why Annie is here on a mystery podcast, I think of this as true thriller. The Paperclip program, and I'll let Annie speak to this, was morally ambiguous at best. And I'm going to let Annie jump in and talk about the moral ambiguity of the United States getting the scientists or the Soviet Union getting the scientists at the end of World War II.
Well, you know, in that way, it is absolutely a mystery and a thriller, because the mystery would be, why did we think it was a good idea to hire Nazi scientists right in the moments after we had defeated the Third Reich? And the thrilling aspect is that perhaps we had to hire them, because if we didn't, the Soviets would. And that was certainly the position of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and those on the Intelligence Committee that were advising the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who as early as 1946, we learn in the Operation Paperclip story, told the Joint Chiefs that the United States should prepare for total war with the Soviets, and that that would include atomic, biological, and chemical warfare. They even set a date, 1952.
Do you think that there was some sort of agreement with the Soviets, or was it an all-out race to cherry-pick the best? And was there an ideological divide that would send one scientist to one camp and another scientist to another camp?
Well, there was absolutely no agreement between the Soviets. Just look at the Nuremberg trials as an example, okay? The first Nuremberg trial, where all the allies, the Russians, the United States, the French, and the British, all agreed together to try the major Nazi war criminals at Nuremberg, and we did. But by the end of that trial, friendliness and partnership had broken down to such a degree that there was no longer any kind of an ability to cooperate. And the subsequent trials, the 12 Nuremberg trials that followed, were prosecuted only by the Americans. So the Soviets were now enemy number one. You know, it's interesting that you asked about where did that divide happen? And it happened exactly like this. Everybody wanted to go with the Americans. The Americans had the most money. And the Americans also, oddly, and this is one of the sort of really disturbing parts of the book, I think, and researching and reporting the enigma of Operation Paperclip, is that the Americans had respect for the German scientists. At least a lot of them did, whereas the Soviets hated them. I mean, think about the brutality of those two enemies in the war and how decimated the Soviet Union was, how many people they lost.
Well, not just the fact that they were enemies, but they had been betrayed by Germany.
Absolutely.
Because they had started out as allies, and then, oops, the Eastern Front opened up.
Even more important of a point you've made, exactly. I mean, the betrayal by Hitler. Oh, let's be friends. Actually, I changed my mind. I've secretly been plotting an attack. And I don't think that would ever be forgiven.
Was there, in the scientists, you know, a lot of the scientists were members of the Nazi Party. All of them then claimed that they had to become Nazis in order to continue, retain their positions at universities, retain their jobs, retain their lives, etc. Do you think that that's true? Or do you think they were ideologues? Do you think that they did believe in the Third Reich and the cause of Aryan supremacy?
Mm-hmm. Operation Paperclip had 1,600 Nazi scientists. I profiled 21 of them. And I know I can speak well and, you know, with a manner of authority on the 21. And of those 21, 20 were not only ardent Nazis, but but committed to the ideals of the Third Reich. Many of them were members of the paramilitary squads, the SS and the SA, these awful institutions that, you know, were at the tip of the spear of Nazi Germany. And that, I think, is one of the really more disturbing elements, that so many of these guys, including Wernher von Braun, who later led our space program, himself a member of the SS, by the way, an officer, were able to present themselves as the good Germans, those who were just following along because they didn't have a choice.
And I guess that was something that the United States government was more than willing to go along with in order to get the scientists they felt they needed, because you're right, they did. Russia was, or at that point, the Soviet Union was public enemy number one. I think Churchill thought so.
Mm-hmm.
Not sure Roosevelt did, but certainly Truman did. And they were, you know, they were positioning. They were, even before the Iron Curtain dropped, they were positioning themselves to go to battle. It ended up being a Cold War, but nevertheless, there was still a buildup with our Germans versus their Germans.
I mean, and can you imagine the public perception, the average American, so many of whom participated in this hard-fought victory, knowing that we were then hiring Nazi ideologues?
But they didn't know.
No, they didn't know, but they couldn't know. That was exactly it, and that's why the War Department put out this benign public face of Operation Paperclip. And so the program itself was a classified military program. The scientists' dossiers, the truth about what they were doing during the Third Reich was all classified. But the public face was, these are the good Germans.
Well, and it's interesting because were you to pitch this as a story to either a book publisher or like Joe Weisberg did to FX as a story, people would say, no, this, nothing like this could ever happen. No, the Americans would never sleep with the enemy. They would never, you know, not just let them into the country, but let them into the most secret workings.
And not only that, some of their titles, let me just give you one example. Dr. Walter Schreiber. Imagine me telling you this story if it wasn't factually true and, you know, documented and now available declassified in the National Archives. Imagine if I told you, Nancy, did you know that the Surgeon General of the Third Reich, Dr. Walter Schreiber, Major General Dr. Walter Schreiber, the head of concentration camp experiments at Ravensbrück, came to the United States and worked for the U.S. Air Force at the Randolph Air Force Base in Texas? You would not believe me, but it's absolutely true, and it's astonishing, and it's complicated, and I think that's what made me learning about the paperclip story a mystery, because it was like, how could this have happened? That was the big burning question when I decided to write this book. How could this have happened? And it's complicated, and it's confusing, and it's dark-hearted, but ultimately it is thrilling, because you can't imagine what it must have been like in the Cold War. I can.
It's interesting, and this is a little bit of a tangent, that there seems to be a lot of stories coming out in the last 4 or 5 years about World War II and the aftermath of World War II. There was Monuments Men. Once again, if you pitch the story, if someone had pitched this to George Clooney's production company, if it hadn't been real, they would have rolled their eyes and said, that's an impossible. They hid artwork in a salt mine? What do you? That stuff doesn't happen. That's science fiction. Is it the urgency of the fact that the last of this generation is going to be gone soon, and there's just there's almost a compulsion to make sure this story is full story, is told so it's documented, and we can't guarantee that nothing like this will ever be repeated, but at least people will say, see, this has happened before.
I think Yes, and also the even bigger issue at play is the fact that all of those people you mentioned who are on their way out, those great war heroes of World War II, participated in a world war. And we all know that if there is another world war, there's not going to be a lot of people left over to tell the story. And so this is the story of what one would hope is the last world war.
I know that Area 51 is going to become a television show. I think that television is a fantastic medium for these kinds of stories, better even than film. And I want you to talk and tell me whatever you can. I mean, I know it's been announced, so you can talk a little bit about it. But when you look at an examination, a fictionalized or semi-fictional examination of this time, World War II, post-World War II, the Cold War, I'm fascinated by the Americans, which, of course, is written by a former CIA agent about what was going on in the 80s. Because, honestly, if they had not discovered those sleeper cells in New Jersey, could you imagine going and saying there were Soviet spies, then they were, sleeper cells in the United States, and nobody knew they were there before they were discovered? People go, no, the Soviets, they never did anything like that. Well, they did. And I thought that they really captured the paranoia of the time. And so is that something that you're going to go for with Area 51, trying to capture the time as well as the story?
Absolutely. It certainly is about paranoia is a great word, and it's the Cold War paranoia and that idea of need to know, which is the hallmark of science and technology when you're talking about the military, and also the public's idea of should we know. And right at the edge of that is all of us wanting to watch these great television dramas because we feel we do have a need to know. And if we can't know the need to know part, at least give us some good fiction.
Well, it's interesting, and I'm not letting her do it today, but whenever I see Annie, and I've known Annie for a long time, I don't want her to tell me anything, because she knows stuff that will keep me up at night. So I am totally in that fictionalized world of I don't really want to know. I want a great story. That's why I love Paperclip so far. I'm about a third of the way through. It is how many pages?
575.
570. And not light reading. Area 51 was over 600.
Around the same length. A little bit shorter.
It
just got you by the throat.
These stories get you by the throat, and every now and then you have to remind yourself, this is true. This is absolutely, it happened.
Well, our writer on Area 51 is the masterful Chris Carter, the legend behind the X-Files. And so to have somebody like him at the helm of this kind of storytelling is just a complete joy to participate in and to watch and to learn from, because he knows how to tell a story.
Are you shooting yet?
Nope, we're still in the writing stages.
I mean, everybody, and he hasn't really worked on anything since Area 51, seriously. I mean, I think he's done a couple of little things. But
he wanted something that really got him excited, and I think this is it, at least that's what he says. So,
well, we're excited to see it. And so, in conclusion, is there anything else you want to tell us specifically about Operation Paperclip? Has it been optioned?
Brad Pitt optioned it.
Oh, my God!
So it's a funny, and I say that, it's just wonderful to have your very serious non-fiction subjects be interesting to people who are interesting and who make great films. And I just think about this idea that these subjects that are historical and that used to be sort of looked at as perhaps, the olden days, are actually coming to life with this vibrancy that makes them accessible to a lot of people, and I just think that is terrific.
Well, I should have, in speaking about the books about World War II, I should have mentioned Unbroken, Laura Hillenbrand's fantastic story, and of course Brad Pitt's partner Angelina Jolie has optioned that and is directing it. Mm-hmm. So it must maybe this period is going to become a family
yes.
business for Brangelina. But they both are serious filmmakers in addition mm-hmm. to being bold-faced names and mm-hmm. famous wherever they go. I think they bring a serious intent to the subject of filmmaking. Mm-hmm. And I think you're in good hands there. And anybody attached?
Well, you know, one more thought about that is what I think is fascinating is when filmmakers and actors are able to bring, like, for example, look at World War Z, a movie I happen to love. A fantastic book.
Loved it.
Loved the book. The book is brilliant. The movie is very different. So you want to have this, you want to have books, at least I do, as being the leaping off point for capturing that same sense of what the book is, but understanding that there's a different audience and it's a different genre. And they did the same thing with 12 Years a Slave. Amazing book, but an amazing film in a different way. And so I think it's incredible to be able to provide that foundation for somebody then to take it to a new audience. Because for somebody like myself, ultimately, it's really about, like, how many people can know about this story? Because I think it's a story worth telling.
Well, that's generally the impetus for a writer. And so on your Facebook page, you were recently in Washington, D.C. at the National Archives with a very subtle hint that you were starting work on your next project. Any hints?
The hint would be that it's the third book that makes this series a trilogy. So you have Area 51, then I take you back in time to how the military-industrial complex began, right there in the last ruins of the Reich. And then I take you all the way forward to the most advanced research science projects that the Department of Defense is currently engaged in.
I can't wait. Have they given you a deadline?
August 1st.
Oh my God, this woman writes like a mad thing. Anyway, thank you, Annie.
Oh, Nancy.
For the time, your time. I know we're here at the Los Angeles Times Festival of Books. Mystery Inc. Bookstore has provided us the space, for which we are thankful. It's always great to see Annie. I'm not even going to tell you guys how long we've known each other.
Nancy taught me how to write.
If only. No one can teach anyone how to write. Anyway.
Except Nancy.
Anyway, thanks again.
Thank you.
It was really wonderful.
Next week in episode 10, Speaking of Mysteries stays in the World War II era when we talk to Alan First about his latest novel, Midnight in Europe. Alan considers his series of novels about Europe in the years leading up to and in the beginning of the war as really one very long book with, to date, 13 chapters. Midnight in Europe is getting raves in the press. Tom Nolan devoted his entire column in Saturday's Wall Street Journal to a glowing review. On a side note, it was Tom Nolan who first introduced me to Mr. First's novels. And Alan was the subject of this week's New York Times Book Review Section's By the Book column. Until next week, this is Nancy Clare, Speaking of Mysteries.